Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my very great pleasure as director of the LSE to welcome the British Humanist Association to our old theatre. Under the name of the Ethical Union, the British Humanist Association shares a number of founding fathers. Godfathers would somehow be inappropriate, but founding fathers with the LSE, Shaw and the Webbs and so on. And indeed, we're almost the same age. The LSE was founded in 1895, and I see the Ethical Union was founded in 1896. They must have been amazingly busy about 100 years ago, those people. Professor Richard Dawkins is vice president of the British Humanist Association, amongst many other things. And it's a particular pleasure to welcome him to the LSE as well. Richard Dawkins is the first holder of Oxford's newly endowed Chair of Public Understanding of Science, and he is a professorial fellow of New College, Oxford. He was born in Africa, educated in England, did his undergraduate degree at Oxford, and then read a doctorate under the supervision of Nico Tinbergen, the eminent ethologist. After 2 years on the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley, he returned to Oxford, where he has been successively a university lecturer and reader in zoology before taking up his present appointment in 1995. He is, of course, perhaps best known, at least popularly, for his books, The Selfish Gene in 1976, The Extended Phenotype, The Blind Watchmaker, River Out of Eden, and most recently, Climbing Mount Improbable. All of these have been, at the appropriate times, on their bestseller lists, which of course gives rise to great jealousy in the academic world. Even more jealousy-making, The Selfish Gene and The Blind Watchmaker have been the subject of BBC Horizon programmes, and in 1991, Richard Dawkins was selected to give the Royal Institution Christmas Lecture for Children, one of the real accolades for those who popularise science, or better, explain science to the public. His prizes and awards include the Royal Society of Literature Prize, the Los Angeles Times Literary Prize, the Silver Medal of the Zoological Society of London, the Michael Faraday Award of the Royal Society, and a particularly unusual one, the Nakayama Prize for Human Science, which carries with it 3 million yen, which even in these days sounds a lot of money. Most impressively of all, however, I was delighted to see that he has that rare distinction for a current Oxford Don of more than one entry in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. So I can think of few people better fitted to both address the British Humanist Association at the LSE on the very interesting subject of science as religious education. Professor Dawkins.
Thank you very much, Director. It's a great privilege to be here on the anniversary of both these noble institutions, and I'm delighted to be here. As for the Nakayama Prize, I suppose the best thing you can say about 3 million yen is that it's more than 3 million lira, but it's not as much as it sounds. Something very odd happens to our educational values as soon as the religious education class assembles. Imagine as a parallel if the following happened in mathematics lessons. The teacher explains that many people believe that the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter is always equal to the constant pi. But she adds that we must all respect the views of other traditions, some of whom believe that the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of a circle is exactly 3, and of other traditions who believe that the circle is a sacred symbol, and it's therefore sacrilege to pry into its innermost secrets. If this hypothetical story takes place in the United States, the Constitution at this point forbids any further discussion of circles, and the children are encouraged to go to special Sunday schools for their own tradition, in which they will learn the beliefs of their culture. I think it may be the single most insidious aspect of religion that it's an educational one. Instead of encouraging children to discuss evidence critically, it teaches them to respect arguments from tradition, authority, and private revelation. I recently took part in a television discussion in a Manchester studio where a whole lot of local school children were brought in to have a discussion. And the point about this gathering was that they were all drawn from different religions, and the compere went around with a microphone, handing the microphone to one child after another, and each child said, "We believe this," and then the next child said, "Well, we believe that," and the next child said, "Well, we believe the other." And we were all invited there to respect these mutually incompatible beliefs, and nobody raised the question, "Well, if you believe this and you believe that and they're contradictory, who is right?" This was never raised. It was just a matter of, because it's religion, you back off, you don't ask questions, and you don't even argue about it. Tradition. The trouble with tradition is that no matter how long ago a story was made up, it's still exactly as true or untrue now as it was all those hundreds of years ago. If you make up a story that isn't true, then handing it down over however many generations doesn't make it get any truer. Nevertheless, to listen to some people talk, you would think that the fact that something is an ancient tradition somehow gives it, somehow hallows it. To take, for example, the Roman Catholic tradition that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was bodily assumed into heaven. It's not mentioned in the Bible. It wasn't invented until about 6 centuries after Jesus' time. At first it was just simply made up, but then it became a tradition. It went on being handed down over the centuries, and because it was handed down over the centuries, it became apparently truer until it was finally written down as an official Roman Catholic doctrine only as recently as 1950. But of course, all those intervening centuries do nothing to make it any more true. Authority. There is one argument which is sometimes put about authority, and it is that scientists too have to respect authority. I am a biologist and not a physicist, and so it is said I have to respect the authority of physicists. I have to believe when I'm told that you can't go faster than the speed of light. This is an erroneous parallel. It is superficially true that because I'm not a physicist, I have to listen to what physicists say, and I'm not myself in a position to explain why it is that you can't go faster than light. But I know, and you know, and everybody else knows, that there is publicly available evidence that anybody with sufficient qualification, with sufficient evidence, with sufficient education, can go and check up for themselves. So although I can't do it myself, in principle, if I bothered to take the time to learn enough physics, I could. But in the case of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, not even the priests claim that there is any evidence for it. It is simply a matter of authority. Or possibly a matter of internal revelation. People just know inside themselves, with a burning internal conviction, that such and such is true, and we are expected to respect that. Once again, people sometimes come back and say, "Well, you must believe in these internal revealed feelings, otherwise you'd never be confident of things like, 'My husband loves me.' That, too, is a bad argument. If you have confidence that your husband loves you, then the reason is that there is evidence, that through all sorts of little signs, all sorts of little titbits of evidence, all sorts of little looks and talks and squeezes and things, you can tell by evidence, not by internal revelation, but by evidence. You could, of course, be wrong. There are people who have a strong internal feeling that some famous film star loves them when they haven't even met them. And this is a delusion, but nevertheless it is felt with equal internal conviction. Now, inside feelings are valuable in science too, but nobody would ever publish a paper in Nature saying, I know that X is true because I've got this deep internal conviction that it's true. I mean, one laughs, but of course that is precisely what faith in revelation amounts to. A scientist may have a deeply held hunch based even on something aesthetic, but this is never more than a good reason for pursuing a certain line of research. It's never something that you would actually publish as being evidence, as being the reason why it has to be believed. Now, since my title is Science as Religious Education, I ought to deal with the accusation that science is just a religion like any other. It's an accusation that I meet myself, and I can sort of see why, in a way, people do accuse me of the sort of zeal of a fanatical fundamentalist preacher. I've been called an Ayatollah of science. But science is not a religion. Scientific belief, as I said before, is based upon publicly checkable evidence. Religious faith is not only lacking in evidence, its independence from evidence is its crowning glory, its pride and joy, it's shouted from the rooftops. Why else would so much be made of the story of Doubting Thomas? The other apostles are held up to us as virtuous because faith was enough for them. Doubting Thomas, who might be the patron saint of scientists, wanted evidence. Now, of course, I believe in, for example, the fact of evolution. If I sound passionate about it, this is probably because of exasperation with some of the arguments that I sometimes meet. The sort of exasperation that, say, a professor of classics would evince if he met somebody who didn't believe that the Romans had ever existed and the Latin language was a plot dreamed up by Victorian schoolmasters to keep themselves in business. But my strong and apparently sometimes too strongly held belief, as I say, is based upon evidence, whereas a religious person's strongly held belief is not. The religious person will retreat behind a private wall of faith where others cannot penetrate and where it's even thought rather bad manners to try to penetrate. It's even thought rather bad taste to question it. If it's a matter of religious faith, it's my religion, you mustn't question it, you must just accept it. Once again, individual scientists are not perfect. Individual scientists do sometimes slip back into the vice of personal faith. Individual scientists may sometimes believe so single-mindedly in a pet theory that they will go so far as to falsify the evidence. But they do so not with pride, but with shame. The method of science is so designed that it eventually finds them out. And I think there is probably no profession in the world where this kind of cheating is so reviled. There are other professions, I could mention perhaps the legal profession, where I don't say that cheating is what they're paid to do, but certainly making a story, turning a story around so that it appears to read better in a certain light than perhaps it really should, is what a lawyer is paid for and honored for. Whereas science at least pays lip service to the opposite point of view. Now, when it's put to me, as it often is, that science, or some particular part of science, like evolutionary theory, is just a religion like any other, I usually respond with indignant denial, as I've done so far tonight. But I'm sometimes mischievously tempted to go along with the accusation and say, well, you're wrong, science is not a religion, but if you insist on accusing science of being a religion, well, let's accept the charge gratefully and make a bid for equal time on the religious education syllabus. And I think when you think of it like that, an excellent case could be made, and that's what I want to do now. One of the recognized aims of religious education, I suspect, is to encourage pupils to rise above the ordinary, mundane preoccupations of life and reflect sub specie aeternitatis. Think about eternal things. Think about the deep questions of existence. Well, science can offer a vision of the universe and of life which, for humbling poetic inspiration, surely far outclasses any of the mutually contradictory faiths and disappointingly recent traditions admitted by the agreed syllabus. What religious education teacher could be dull if challenged to convey to children some inkling of the age of the earth or the size of the universe? Suppose that at the moment of Christ's death, the news had started traveling around the universe at the maximum possible speed, that's the speed of light, how far would the terrible tidings have reached by now? The answer is that the news could not possibly, under any circumstances whatever, have reached more than 1/50th part of the way across one paltry galaxy, not 1/1000th of the way to our nearest neighbour in the 100 million strong universe of galaxies. The universe at large, in other words, could not be anything other than indifferent to not only Christ and his passion, but all human preoccupations. These are humbling reflections. I've just chosen one rather fanciful one, but anything of that nature could be used to arouse in children that sense of humility, that sense of wonder, which the best kind of religious education surely aspires to do. Turning from arousing the sense of wonder to questions of origins and explanations of existence. All the great religions have had their origin myths. They have all tried to account for the existence of life, the existence of the world. Their accounts are, of course, all mutually contradictory once again. And if we ran science as a religious education class, we would certainly have to consider scientific explanations for origins. Clearly, my own field of Darwinism would figure prominently, and I suppose the children would be invited to consider it, not in the sort of detail that they would do in biology classes, but study Darwinism as a full account of the complexity, of the beauty, the apparent design of living creatures. They could then compare the Darwinian story of the existence of life with the various competing alternatives, which they could be given full accounts of, and they could make up their own minds as to which was the most convincing, and I have little doubt which way their verdict would fall. More sophisticated arguments from design suggest that the laws of physics and the fundamental constants of the universe may be too good to be true, as if they were set up deliberately to make evolution possible. Other physicists have made the argument that the origin of the elements such as carbon, which is crucially important for life, might well not have happened if the laws of physics had been just that little bit different. These are profound and interesting problems, questions which, seems to me, could engage children in the classes which we call religious education classes. It's not religion, but nevertheless, it has the same kind of appeal which ideally religion ought to have, and which I suppose in past centuries it did have. As to this question of whether the universe is a put-up job, whether the laws of physics are too good to be true, I find it genuinely interesting. It's the only even remotely good candidate for an argument for the existence of a divine creator that I've ever encountered. I think ultimately it probably isn't a very good argument, but it's certainly worth considering. If the God of the physicists ever did seem to be necessary, then it would be a perfectly respectable scientific argument that would be being put forward to justify it. It would not be based on faith. It would not be right to categorize it as something that lies beyond the remit of science. It would be a proper scientific argument. The argument that says the laws of physics are too good to be true is a scientific argument. It may be a wrong argument, it may be flawed, but it's a scientific argument, and it has the form. Theoretically, there could have been a very large number of different universes, a very large number of different laws of physics. The one that we live in is one that, in some uncanny way, is calculated to give rise to the larger, heavier elements and ultimately life. And therefore, it is a statistical argument that there must have been a creator. And I think that's a bad argument. All I'm trying to say is that it is wrong to characterize it as an argument that lies beyond and outside the reach of science. By the way, a controversial and intriguing speculation is that there may be lots and lots of universes, and obviously we have to be living in one of them, in one of those that do have the right laws of physics to give rise to life. And it's even been suggested that there may be a Darwinian selection among universes. Universes give birth to daughter universes, and at the moment of giving birth to daughter universes, the laws of physics change, a cosmic analogy to mutation, and only those universes who have laws of physics that give rise to properties that make them last a long time are the ones that we see, are the ones that have time to give birth to yet more daughter universes. Well, probably a wrong argument, but again, it would be the kind of thing that I suspect would engage children, interest them and excite them in my hypothetical religious education classes. Well, so much for Genesis. How about the prophets? Halley's comet will return without fail in the year 2062. This gift of prophecy which science can offer is, of course, in many cases extremely accurate. The accuracy with which the return of a comet can be predicted is very, very great. The accuracy with which an eclipse can be predicted is very great. There are other predictions that science can make which are not so accurate, which are only statistical. And some discussion of the nature of foretelling the future, either with great accuracy, as physicists and cosmologists can do, or with only statistical accuracy, is something which I think would have great educational value. To teach children the difference between a proper scientific foretelling of the future with knowable, measurable, and statable boundaries of error, which may be small and may be large, would be enormously valuable to children in their everyday lives, in reading newspapers, in assessing the leading articles in papers that make forecasts about what's likely to happen. The training in what's the difference between a highly confident forecast and a statistical forecast is one which would be valuable for children all through their lives. Incidentally, these classes would have the effect of, I would hope, putting astrologers and soothsayers and other charlatans out of business. When the RE class turned to ethics, science in my model syllabus would give way to rational moral philosophy. Do the members of the class think there are absolute standards of right and wrong hanging out there in space, or are there just working principles which we can argue about, like do as you would be done by, the greatest happiness of the greatest number, whatever that might mean? In any case, it's a rewarding question to ask from a scientific point of view, where our feelings of right and wrong come from. We are evolved beings, and if we have feelings of right and wrong, if we have feelings of natural justice, if we have feelings of compassion, we are entitled as Darwinians to wonder where these come from. And it's a difficult question. As a Darwinian myself, it's one that I'm very often asked after I've given lectures, and I find it genuinely hard to answer. But it's obviously something, once again, which would engage a class which would be of interest to them once they'd had the necessary Darwinian background to handle it. Particular kinds of questions that might arise would be the preoccupation with the rights of humans as distinct from other species. What is, after all, so special about human life, given that we live in an evolutionary world, given that all other animals are our cousins, given that it's only an accident of history that the intermediates between ourselves and chimpanzees and gorillas and other species are all dead? If they happen to be alive, then we would be faced with a fascinating dilemmas in ethics, moral philosophy, politics. We would be faced, presumably, with some kind of need to draw lines, or perhaps we can argue with the children in class whether drawing lines is always a bad thing, whether it can be justified. Would we be faced with some sort of apartheid if there were a need for laws to distinguish whether some individual really counts as a human, or are they really a chimp if all the intermediates are there? These are thought experiments. There aren't any intermediates, so they are only thought experiments, but they are stimulating and interesting, and I think the children would be challenged by them and interested by them. Another exercise in moral reasoning might be a discussion of the ethics of visiting the sins of the fathers on subsequent generations, in extreme cases, the principle of the vendetta. Most people have a sense of natural justice, and they have a feeling of fairness and unfairness as applied to individuals, but many people apply their calculations of natural justice to whole groups to which individuals belong. So you have the spectacle of individuals wreaking revenge on the grandchildren of those individuals who did some terrible wrong to their own grandparents. This is a very common human practice to apply their natural feelings of natural justice and revenge and so on to the descendants of the original wrongdoers. Perhaps the children might be invited to reflect upon the oddity of that. That's a rather extreme example, but we meet the same kind of thing frequently in our own lives. I think it's probably fair to say that the rise of feminism has seen a lot of injustices rectified, but in some cases we have seen present-day men in effect paying for the injustices of previous men against previous generations of women. One anecdote I recall from my own Oxford college was when we were debating whether to admit women into the college, many of us have been working very hard to do. At one point, the undergraduates, who in those days, of course, were all male, were consulted, and they voted overwhelmingly that women should be admitted to the college. And then somebody, one of the fellows, commented that this was extremely altruistic of them, because after all, this would be taking away places that they could have had. Now, this person was apparently overlooking the fact that these young men were already in the college. It wasn't altruistic at all. The only way you could think that was altruistic would be if you identified the male sex as a kind of monolithic body to which or from which feelings of justice and feelings of entitlement and fairness could be applied as a monolithic unit. Once again, an interesting question for discussion in class. Coming now to eschatology and the study of last things, we know from the second law of thermodynamics that all complexity, all life, all sorrow, all laughter, all human experience, everything we know, is hell-bent on leveling itself out into cold nothingness. Incidentally, the kind of rhetoric I've just indulged in, the rhetoric of the bleak, cold universe, is another thing which might be explored, that kind of rhetoric, the extent to which we can use emotive language about things like the universe could be justified. That is another thing that might be discussed. We know that the universe is expanding and may well expand forever. Whatever happens, we know that the Earth is going to be destroyed in some 60 million centuries. We know that the universe may come to a definite end, or it may go on forever, and those are two different physical models, two different models that physicists talk about, and I suspect the children would be fascinated to discuss them as well. Time locally comes to an end in miniature crunches called black holes. All children love black holes. The laws of the universe seem to be true all over the universe, but they might change in these local crunches. Once again, we have food for thought in these classes for children. We would come back to questions of ultimate meaning and perhaps reflect on our own place in the universe. We're on our own. We cannot rely upon some cosmic father figure. We must grow up and have a mature self-reliance on our own resources. So I think that science could give a good account of itself in, let's not call it religious education, but it would be those hours set aside in the week which would fill the same role as religious education. But I do want to concede that it wouldn't be enough. Some familiarity with, in this country, the King James Bible, in other countries something else, I think is important for anyone wanting to read English literature, for example. The point's been made often enough. Together with the Book of Common Prayer, the Bible gets 58 pages in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. And I thank the director very much, incidentally, for noting my own contribution to that excellent volume. Only Shakespeare has more quotations than the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer. Clearly, if we were dealing with Arabic literature, it would be very different, but it is remarkable that there's not a single quotation from the Quran in the Oxford Dictionary Quotations. When we need to understand, read, take our allusions in English literature, I think it is important to know the provenance of phrases like through a glass darkly, all flesh is as grass, the race is not to the swift, crying in the wilderness, reap the whirlwind amid the alien corn, eyeless in Gaza, Job's comforters, the widow's mite. So I'm not in favour of abolishing the study of the Bible, just I think that the Bible should be studied as literature so that it can be used to interpret and understand other literature. There is, I suppose, too, something to be said for studying a wide diversity of religions. I've noticed from my daughter's religious education classes that actually religious education nowadays has become a sort of branch of cookery. They mostly have to make different sort of dishes of the world. I suppose it all helps to foster tolerance and mutual understanding. But I think there is some virtue in studying religions comparatively. Children may then observe that the various religions contradict each other. A possibility, by the way, that has given rise to some misgivings among apologists who fear that the children will become confused. Well, they probably will become confused, yes. Instruction in comparative religion may help children to understand how apparently decent and humane people can advocate the execution of a distinguished novelist for apostasy, the stoning to death of adulteresses, the judicial lashing of women who have had the misfortune to be raped in the presence of fewer than four male witnesses. Which brings me back to the original charge of zealotry and bigotry among scientists. There may be some occasional apparent justice in it, but when it comes to bigotry, we are mere amateurs at the game. We are content to argue with those who disagree with us. We don't shoot them. Now, it's fashionable to deny that the violence and hatred that we see in places like Northern Ireland has anything to do with religion or religious education. Nice, liberal people like us, even if we're not religious ourselves, are supposed to respect religion enough not to blame it for Northern Ireland and similar horrors. Northern Ireland has nothing to do with religion. It's all to do with poverty, oppression, historic wrongs and grievances. Well, I fear it has everything to do with religion, and specifically with segregated religious education of children. I don't mean to imply that people are shot or kneecapped because they don't believe in the assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. That sort of thing happened in the past, but it doesn't happen now. I'm happy to admit that religious thoughts are not uppermost in the mind of an IRA murderer. That's not the point I'm trying to make. There has been oppression, poverty in Northern Ireland, and of course it's the lingering memory of that that fuels the hatred, much of it, in Northern Ireland. But my point is, how do people know who to oppress? The two warring tribes can't be distinguished by colour. They speak the same language. Give or take the odd bowler hat, they wear the same range of clothes. It is true that the heightened sensitivities of that unhappy province enable people to smell out the tribe by such subtle cues as a surname or even a Christian name. To many of us, William and Kevin are just names, but to some in Northern Ireland, they could be a matter of life or death. But the only reason these labels have any significance is that they are statistically associated with probable religion. They're giveaways. We could make an analogy between religion in Northern Ireland and what biologists call a reproductive isolating mechanism. Not a genetic one, perhaps, although it might even be that, but a mimetic isolating mechanism. In the world of biological evolution, gene pools that are isolated from one another reproductively tend to drift apart. And this normally comes about by geographical separation. The proverbial mountain range or a stretch of water separates what was previously one interbreeding population. And because there is no longer any gene flow, no longer any intercourse, literally, between these different populations, in the fullness of evolutionary time, they will become more and more different from one another, more separate from one another, they'll cease to resemble each other. Eventually, they won't be able to mate with each other, even if they do meet. They eventually do meet, they will then perhaps compete with each other, and there's a reasonable likelihood that one will drive the other extinct. Geographical separation is one basis for that, one way in which it might happen. But there are other possibilities. Language could theoretically have the same result. If, for example, Flemish speakers mate only with Flemish speakers and French speakers mate only with French speakers, then we could expect that over the centuries there would be a build-up of genetic differences between the two language groups, even if they live cheek by jowl together. Now, in the case of Northern Ireland, we're not talking about language. We are talking, I suggest, solely about religion. Not that the actual things they believe matter, but the fact that religion is a label which is used for a them or us separation. I wanted to read a few passages from what I found a rather moving article in The Spectator a few weeks ago by Sean O'Callaghan, who was and is in jail as an IRA murderer. He explains how he was born into an Irish Catholic family in the 1950s, and he goes on to his education. "We were taught that Irish Catholics were special to God and that the Virgin Mary was an Irish Colleen. Padraic, Pierce, and Easter Week were inextricably woven into a seamless mix of blood and sacrifice for country and the church. Educated in the main by nuns and Christian brothers, we learned that God and Irish nationalism marched hand in hand to a tune shrouded in mystery, but always clear to the faithful." Then, in 1968, the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland, he goes on about how he grew up and became a teenager, the civil rights movement burst. "The nationalist cause was sermoned and preached from pulpit and Doyle, and fool that I was, I fell for the big lie. I joined the Provisional IRA in 1970, aged 15, and eventually ended up in Northern Ireland, where in 1974 I committed two murders in County Tyrone. One of those murders serves to highlight, in a gut-wrenching way, the extent of the link between extreme nationalism and Irish Catholicism. Peter Ignatius Flanagan was an Irish Catholic and a detective inspector in the RUC Special Branch. Stationed in Omagh, he was a particular hate figure among local Catholics. He had betrayed his own. I was one of three people who murdered him in a public house in Omagh in August of 1974. Murder is murder, an obscenity, and the most terrible of crimes against humanity. Apologies in such circumstances are, I believe, only grotesque and self-serving. Actions are what matter. I can never redress the balance, but I can try. After the murder, we drove to a house a couple of miles from Omagh. Within a couple of hours, two of us were driven to a Catholic parochial house some distance away. I knew the house and the two priests who lived there quite well, as I and other IRA people often stayed there. We were greeted joyously, showered with holy water and prayers, and fed like kings. An abominable man who abandoned his faith and sold his soul to the devil. That was how the senior of the two priests described the murdered man to us. Two young murderers as we sat at their table." And he goes on to say that the same story could be told over and over again by his colleagues in the IRA. I want to return to science and the difference between science and religion and the charge of zealotry. There is a very, very important difference between feeling strongly, even passionately, about something because we've thought about the evidence for it, or we know that somebody else has, and feeling strongly about something because it's been internally revealed to us, or internally revealed to somebody in history and subsequently hallowed by tradition. There's all the difference in the world between a belief that is supported by nothing more than tradition, authority, or revelation, and a belief that one's prepared to defend by quoting evidence and logic. And the importance of this difference is perhaps the most worthwhile lesson that our kind of religious education might attempt to convey. Thank you very much.
I'm afraid that due to prior commitments, Professor Dawkins has to go away from the LSE at 7 o'clock sharp. But that gives us a quarter of an hour, I think, for questions or discussion. And it's usual in this rather complicated lecture theatre to take the questions alternately from, if I may, the stalls and the circle, to give everybody a chance. Those in the circle will find it difficult to hear the questions that those in the stalls, certainly the back of the stalls, might ask. So I would ask you, please, to wait until one of the stewards comes your way when I've indicated or pointed to you, so that you can use one of these microphones, which will then enable everybody else, as well as Professor Dawkins, to hear the question you're asking. So, could I first have if you could just put your hand up, please, and I can, yes, you, sir. Ask the white shirt.
I would like to just mention one aspect of science as religion, which I have personally experienced, and Professor Dawkins didn't mention. There are a large number of beliefs in science, especially in biology, which I have handled over nearly 40 years, which are currently believed in the same sense as religion, and people will not, many scientists are not prepared to examine their own hypotheses, their own beliefs, in the same way as many religious people aren't.
Could you give an example?
Well, it's a technical example, but you know, for example, I know the chairman does, that subcellular fractionation, you know, when you separate cells into different parts, and you examine their chemistry. Now, I wrote a book in 1972 showing that that is illegal thermodynamically. And I've addressed this problem many, many times. And frankly, my colleagues don't want to know. I'm just a particular example of the fact that there are many scientific beliefs which the people who believe them behave in the same dogmatic way as...
I can't comment on the particular example that you give. All I would say is that good science pays lip service, at least, to the view that you and those who disagree with you ought to be able to write down a list of things that could be done which would decide the matter once and for all to the satisfaction of both of you. And I suspect that couldn't be done for religion. I think that's a crucial difference. If there are disagreements remaining in science, it's usually because the evidence is incomplete.
Yes, lady in there.
Thank you. You mentioned religions, or particularly religious education, as creating mimetic separation. I wondered if you could give other examples. The only ones I've read of yours have been to do with religion, of mimetic separation, and perhaps say something about the mechanism and consequences of this kind of separation. How strong an analogy is it with genetics and separation,
yes,
in fact?
I haven't made much of a study of this. I'm told that in Los Angeles there are gangs of youths who are identified by a different kind of shoes that they wear. And I was warned when in certain parts of Los Angeles that if I wore a certain kind of shoe, I was in danger of being shot, because that was a label which had been used to identify these mimetically divergent groups of people. But I haven't made a study of it. I would like to do so. So I can't really answer with any authority.
Yes. Wait, hang on a minute.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I have a feeling that tonight you you bit more than you could chew. I'm rather appalled by your I can see that you're intolerant of fundamentalism in religion and so on, but I thought your sort of compulsive hatred of Islam, which is totally scientifically unjustified. I mean, you couldn't mention one scientific evidence why you should have hated Islam so much. I'm appalled by your sheer intolerance of other beliefs and other belief systems. What is wrong with the premise that you should respect other views and other religions. You made a great dance about religions being contradictory without giving an ounce of evidence towards that. I mean, there can be another completely different view proving to you that religions are in fact not contradictory. I mean, you simply assumed that religions are contradictory, which is totally unscientific and totally unworthy of you and your reputation. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to believe that, but I can't help wondering why it is that religions throughout history have always gone to war with each other over their beliefs in that case. If they all say the same thing, then why would they kill each other for it? Well, that must be a great comfort to the people who are being shot.
There's also dogma, and therefore scientific dogma in religion. And therefore interpreting this is a very different matter.
I think there's a very interesting point. I mean, if... Richard, let me try and ask the question in another way. I suppose there may be one exception or two exceptions, but virtually every culture has some kind of religious belief or other, and defining that in terms of a belief which is in principle not disprovable. I mean, I would define the difference between science and religion. Science is in principle disprovable. I'm a Popperian. Religion, by definition, is not. So, but every culture has some such belief, and most of them identify them with some kind of godlike figure. Now, the details, and this is your point, I think, the details are infinitely variable. This is because human beings are playful. I mean, we endlessly elaborate on these things. But since we all believe in some sense in a god, doesn't this suggest that he or she might exist? I know. Yeah. But what I'm trying to do is to interpret. I mean, you couldn't hear the question, so I'm trying to interpret the question.
I think yes. I mean, thank you. I think it's a curious belief. It's a curious argument that because a lot of people believe X must be true. I think we do have to look at what the evidence actually is, and I'm sure you agree with that.
Yeah.
Have
you any idea about how we could have evolved such a curious phenomenon?
Oh, I mean, I think that's a fascinating thing. I would tend to treat it as one of the general set of questions about why the human brain has given rise to so many. I mean, why do we have music? Why do we have poetry? Why do we have religion? The human brain is an immensely complicated mechanism which was shaped by natural selection in the wild for survival in a particular way. And it now finds itself in a very different environment where it's flowering in all sorts of peculiar ways. One of the things it does is to... especially the child mind, I think, tends to believe what it's told at a certain age. And therefore, whatever you tell a child, however arbitrary and local, parochial it may be, the child will tend to believe it and will tend to pass it on to its children. And so you would expect to get, and you do get, in different parts of the world, local beliefs which are genuinely local, which apply to that part of the world and not to other parts of the world, although they began in an arbitrary way and then they get passed on in a quasi-genetic manner. So I think it's something like that, but also you then have to ask, well, why do some of these beliefs stick around and others not? And I think it's very easy to make a case that certain beliefs are very congenial. Belief in life after death, for example, is obviously very congenial. And people tend to believe what they want to believe. And so that could be the sort of equivalent of selection. Why do certain beliefs stick around and others not?
Lady in green, Beth.
I found that during your talk, you made a very interesting case for science in religious education. But to my mind, you did not make a case for science as religious education. I would be very interested if you could, very briefly, make a case for it as religious education. And in doing so, I wonder if you could bear in mind the limits of science.
because you've said a great deal about science being something that is, by definition, scientific, capable of experimentation, of replication, and so on. Surely there are many things central to our lives which cannot be replicated accurately. Let's take, for example, or indeed proved, love, happiness. Extremely difficult to replicate either of those accurately, because when I love, I may not do what you see as loving. People who are happy may exhibit a certain set of characteristics, but somebody who's happy may cry. Now, we know that crying isn't part of happiness normally, but that doesn't mean the person isn't feeling happy. It's almost impossible to, in fact, do accurate, replicable experiments that are statistically significant about absolutely consistent behavior demonstrating the most fundamental experiences of human life. Even orgasm cannot accurately be defined, because the feelings that people have cannot be proved by the things that come up on the electric meters.
I think there's an important distinction to be made between, on the one hand, something which is hard to replicate because it's so variable. I mean, orgasm may vary, and so it's not possible to replicate it exactly. There's a very different matter from saying that that's in principle beyond the reach of science, in the way that a religious person might claim that, say, the soul is, or the life after death. I find myself very comfortable with the statement that you make about orgasm, because I don't find that a fundamental challenge to science. I think that's merely saying that people are very complicated, and if you try to examine the same phenomenon on successive occasions, you're going to find differences, because there's a very large number of variables which are impinging upon it. I don't find that
a profound
point.
I'm not talking about
point.
Physiological differences. I'm talking about the emotional experience.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, there's a difference between saying that that science finds it hard to handle in practice because there are so many variables and it's so complicated, and the more far-reaching statement that says that there are things which are in principle outside the reach of science. And I think you may be confusing the two.
But that puts it into exactly the same realms as spirituality. Forget religion, spirituality. The experience of spirituality is very comparable to the experience of the emotions that we feel, such as love, happiness, the particular ecstasy that may accompany orgasm. They are all things which cannot be measured, are within the human being, are firmly and deeply believed by them, cannot be externally demonstrated. It's just their personal experience.
Once again, I have no problem.
Just as profound, surely.
I have no problem with what you're saying about feelings and love and the variation among them. When you say spirituality, I don't know what you mean. I could ask you what you mean, and if you were to say something like surviving after death, then I know what you're talking about, and I think that is something quite different. That's making a claim which I suspect to be false, and it cannot be embraced in that easy way by saying, well, it's just like love and feelings and happiness and orgasm. It isn't. It's something much more radical. A much more radical claim is being made if by spirituality you mean something, say, that survives death. That you can get your teeth into, and I believe it's wrong.
Isn't that rather like somebody who's inorganic saying it doesn't exist?
Now, in the blue, yes. Then in there.
Well, I completely concur about the points you're making about the virtues of teaching people to think critically and very much questioning this fad for respect, when respecting other traditions and so on, when it's not either based on fact or why should you respect a belief if have any respect if it hasn't actually been earned in the first place. And questioning authority and mythology and so on. I think that's true. And I also think that the great virtue of science is that obviously there are natural laws that have an objective reality, and regardless of the failing of individual scientists and so on, science is always engaging with an objective reality, and therefore has its own certain kind of dynamism and can progress forward. But the one question I have got is actually one of the examples you give in a social setting, for example, Northern Ireland. I think there's very real limitations to using the tools of natural science to explain social situations. So, for example, I mean, I think you yourself. I completely agree with you and go along with your project of attacking religion. But in the example of Northern Ireland, I think you're mystifying what the social conflict in a different way. Because, for example, it's nothing to do with religion, the conflict there. It was a political conflict, and the reason it's been a political conflict, certainly since partition, is because traditionally one side has wanted Ireland to belong to Ireland, and Britain has wanted to remain in Ireland, and that's what the war has been about. So I don't think, so what I'm trying to say is that you can't use the science to explain social phenomenon, because politics is driven by something different to Darwinism or anything else.
Yes, I apologize if I injected too much natural science into that. Perhaps you could just rephrase it in another way. I would simply like to repeat to anybody who goes to Northern Ireland and says that it's nothing to do with religion, how do the warring factions identify which ones they're going to oppress, which ones they're going to attack, unless it's religion? They don't have language as the people do in Belgium. They don't have colour as they did in South Africa. They've only got religion as the label that separates one group from another. And I suppose that the relevance to religious education is that it does suggest a positive formula for solving the problem in a generation, which admittedly is a long time, which is to somehow prevent segregated religious education classes, prevent there being separate Catholic and Protestant classes where people, where children can be brought up with their ancient tribal hatreds. If they were all educated together, instead of religion being used as the pretext for having segregated schools, then you wouldn't have the separation which makes it possible for all the oppression and disadvantaging that undoubtedly goes on.
I think just time for one more question. Yes, sir, you're at the back.
What is the answer to the scientific and humanist answer to the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
The egg... if by that we mean the self-replicating information, life is all about the replication down the generations of coded information. The chicken, the body, is the temporary receptacle of the DNA, the coded information. That's the essence of modern neo-Darwinism.
On that note, I think I'm looking at the time. I'm afraid I must bring the meeting to a close. It could clearly go on for hours and hours, and that's a great tribute to our speaker. I also would like to think that his talk has also been a great tribute to those of our forefathers that we share with the British Humanist Association. The motto of the London School of Economics, in Latin I'm afraid, but it translated into English means to discover or to know the causes of things. And our founders, like the British Humanist Association founders, did not rule out anything from that debate or that discussion. The things that we've been talking about, stimulated by Professor Dawkins, have of course been emotionally highly charged. But I can tell you, I've been chairman of some equally tense meetings when what we've been discussing is the exact nature of the monetary supply. and my fear is that if people want to fight, they'll find some label, whether it's M0, M4, Catholic or Protestant, by God they will use it to fight. And what one really needs to explore is why those kinds of things happen and what people think they're doing when they're behaving in that way. But at least in the context in which you chose to introduce it to us, I think we've had a number of very interesting and very thoughtful comments, both from yourself, if I may, and also from the audience, whom I congratulate for their forbearance. Thank you all. On your behalf, thank you very much.